This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Next up, it's a Plains FM feature interview, keeping you in touch with the people and events happening in our Canterbury community.
Founded in 1999, the Canterbury History Foundation was formed to encourage and support research, publication, and interest in history within the wider Canterbury region. It also makes grants available to history postgraduate students. Each year, the foundation hosts the Jim Gardiner Lecture and awards the Rhodes History Medal, which recognises lifetime achievement and the voluntary support of historical research, archives, museums, or community awareness of the value of history. This year's recipient was Belinda Jones. We went along to the University of Canterbury and recorded this year's Jim Gardiner Memorial Lecture by Dr. Ursula Rack, entitled Making Climate Change Visible, A Short History of Antarctic Climate Research. But first, here is Emeritus Professor of History, Dr. Geoffrey Rice, to tell us about the man named for this lecture, Jim Gardiner.
Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Welcome, everybody. It's good to see hardy souls like you out this afternoon. We did order the weather, by the way, to be appropriate for the subject of climate change. My task in the next couple of minutes is to introduce, for those of you who may not have heard of him before, Jim Gardiner, and why we have a lecture devoted to him. We remember Jim as a major figure in the post-Second World War History Department at the University of Canterbury. Neville Phillips was the professor, and there were a number of English-born lecturers, but Jim was instrumental in establishing New Zealand history at Canterbury University. He was born in North Canterbury at Waiau in 1915 and died in Christchurch on the 14th of July 2012. He was educated at Elmwood School and Christ College, enrolled at Canterbury University College in 1933. He graduated with first class honours in history in 1937 and won the Bowen Prize for that year. After a year at Christchurch Teachers College, he became a school teacher, and in 1941 he married another teacher, Madge Biggar, who had been the Ducks of Ashburton District High School, and they were to have three sons and a daughter in their family. In the Second World War, Jim served in the New Zealand Medical Corps, first of all in the Pacific, and then in Egypt, North Africa and Italy, rising to the rank of sergeant. And after the war, he returned briefly to school teaching until he was appointed a lecturer in history at Canterbury University College in 1948. While lecturing and raising a young family, he wrote his first book, The Amuri, A County History, and this was immediately recognised as a classic of New Zealand historiography. It set new standards in New Zealand regional and local history, and an updated second edition was published in 1983. Jim taught a wide range of courses in the history department, including one on the French Revolution. And as I said, he introduced the first courses in New Zealand history taught at this university. He also helped to revive the Canterbury Historical Association, our sister body, after its wartime recess, and organised its junior branch. And almost single-handed, he raised funds to set up the J.M. Sherard Award in New Zealand Regional History as a memorial to his friend, the late Jock Sherard. And Jim organised and judged this award for its first 20 years. He was heavily involved in completing the three-volume History of Canterbury, editing and contributing to Volume 3. And at short notice, he was called on to help finish the history of the University of Canterbury in time for its centennial celebrations in 1973. Gosh, and here we are celebrating another anniversary of the university, and another history will be published at the end of this year. Jim was also very active in the New Zealand Historic Places Trust, and he served two terms on the board up until 1989. He was the life and soul of the Canterbury Committee, and even learned how to do Cobb Cottage restoration. He retired from the university in 1976, and then in 1979 he became the founding president of the New Zealand Historical Association, a position he filled with energy and distinction until 1982. And this year, the NZHA is holding its national conference here at Canterbury. Thanks to his friendship with Bill Oliver, Professor Bill Oliver, and his contribution to the Oxford History of New Zealand in 1981, he became heavily involved in the Dictionary of New Zealand Biography and was the driving force behind the strong Canterbury presence in Volume 1, published in 1990. Now, by this time, Jim was 75, when most historians, as I always remark, are reduced to pruning the roses. Yes, I'm one of them. But in 1992, he published another classic of New Zealand historiography, A Pastoral Kingdom Divided, the story of the breakup of the Cheviot estate. And this was another pioneering and brilliant piece of detective work using bank archives as well as family letters to uncover the real story behind the breakup of the estate. And later on in 1999, he published a collection of articles on local and regional history entitled Where They Lived. Jim remained very fit and active in his retirement, riding a bike well into his 90s. And in 2007, he was appointed an officer of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to historical research. And then in 2009, he amazed us all by producing his last work, a slim volume on the origins of the arbitration system in Australia and New Zealand. Jim died on Bastille Day 2012, very appropriate for someone who taught about the French Revolution. He was an outstanding teacher of New Zealand history and made a significant contribution to New Zealand historiography. He was a short man, but he radiated liveliness. And my recollection of Jim is that he was always cheerful, smiling and alert. And any conversation with Jim soon produced jokes and laughter. Those of us privileged to have been his colleagues and friends over many years also knew him to be a man of great integrity, compassion and generosity. In 2015, the History Foundation donated plaques to be placed on two seats beside the old history building to remember Neville Phillips on one side and Jim Gardner on the other, Jim's daughter Helen helping to unveil his plaque. And sadly, Helen passed away unexpectedly early this year, having represented the family at this lecture for over a decade. Now it's my privilege to introduce our speaker for today, Dr. Ursula Rack. And you all are aware of the title of the talk, Making Climate Change Visible, A Short History of Antarctic Climate Research. Ursula is a polar historian and an adjunct fellow at Gateway Antarctica here at the University of Canterbury. She's a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society in London and was Institute Associate at the Scott Polar Research Institute, Cambridge, from 2018 to 2022. She teaches Antarctic history and has spent five seasons in the Antarctic. And it's a great pleasure that I invite Ursula to address us on the subject, Making Climate Change Visible, A Short History of Antarctic Climate Research.
Tēnā koutou katoa. As Jeff already said, my name is Ursula Rack. I'm originally from Austria, so therefore my accent. But I have spent five seasons in the Antarctic and I'm really a passionate historian on focus on the Antarctic history. So I love history as such. When I was 9 years old and my father brought me a book from a petrol station and it was my first sticker book. And the first pictures I got was from Cook, from Hillary and from Scott. And so I started to read all the stories to this. And then it started in the same time that I got interested in history as such. It was Napoleon at this time and the French Revolution. And then it always came back to the colder regions. So I was always interested. And I'm not a very hot person. I love the cold more. I have a warm heart, but yeah. So, and this is the reason why I always came to this bag. And then I started my PhD about social conditions on German and Austro-Hungarian Antarctic, as a polar expeditions, Arctic and Antarctic. And then my husband, of course, he went from 1996 onto the Antarctic. So, of course.
Wow, and it's five tours now.
I'd start my sixth in November. However, you will see during that presentation that this involves many different aspects of history. Today, I will focus on the history of science. In the past few years, I worked a lot with climate scientists, and one of my latest papers is on the Indian Ocean and is based on three German expeditions. And it became clear that the ocean warmed significantly in the past 120 years and is still increasing. So this is my background and so on. Climate change is in discussion almost on a daily basis. And we see it also in catastrophic weather events we can only look outside here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and many implications are attached to it, such as questions about insurance, where to build, and how to live with the effects of these changes. At first, I want to focus on terms such as climatology and ice ages. The science is relatively young, and many outcomes are rediscovered for modern interpretation of scientific findings. Antarctic exploration in the last 130 years was mainly based on climate research. It had also economic implications and not only science. Bigger, faster ships needed more information on traffic routes, and geological findings were important for resources for a fast industrial development. And there was also the whaling business. However, the researchers spending time in the Antarctic made great measurements and observations, and their data is still very valuable for us today. My third part will show the global influence and the changing climate and weather patterns, and will go a little bit deeper what that means for New Zealand and especially its glaciers. The picture illustrates the risks under which the early explorers had to work and live. And in this case, sea ice pressure ridges could be dangerous to their lives, as Ernest Shackleton and his men had to experience in 1915 when the Endurance sank. But what is climate? What is climatology? What is glaciology? What are ice ages? Alexander von Humboldt used the term climate very specifically in relation to the perception to the human body. Over the time, the term climate was transferred into the science disciplines. And many geographers and geologists are researching snow and ice, and especially the ice ages. Glaciology evolved in the 1920s as an independent discipline from physics and chemistry. Here are some pioneers of climatology, glaciology, and the ice ages. Milutin Milanković was a Serbian mathematician and charted the ice ages of the Pleistocene, an epoch that began 1.8 million years ago and ended approximately 11,500 years ago. He is best known for his theory how small variation in the tilt of the Earth's axis and sun energy explain the regularity of ice ages. Also, his charts are still used today. They are also disputed. However, as for many other scientists, their findings brought great achievements. With newer methods of observations, their findings can be adjusted and are the basis for modern scientific work. Svante Arrhenius was a Swedish chemist and physicist and Nobel Prize recipient. He was the first who quantified the influence of changes in the concentration of carbon dioxide, CO2, in the atmosphere on the temperature of the Earth's surface. It is now known as the greenhouse effect. He called it hothouse. He predicted climate change caused by industrial emissions of CO2, which he already published in 1896. Some scientists before him described parts of this effect, but he took it further, and it was then finally accepted, especially when ice core drilling started in the 1960s. But this I will explain in a minute. Vladimir Köppen was a Russian-German scientist, and his son-in-law was Alfred Wegener, who was famous for his continental drift he introduced in 1912. Both worked together, supporting Milankovitch's finding. Köppen and Wegener published in 1924 a paper, The Climates of the Geological Past. Köppen had the experience from the Alps and vast knowledge on his side. Wegener brought in new ideas and experiences from the Greenland ice sheet, and so their collaboration led finally to a textbook for meteorology. The book, The Thermodynamics of Atmosphere, was used for decades. Louis Agassiz, a Swiss geologist, published in 1837 his glacial theory. He is seen as the founder for the glaciology. In times of Agassiz, continental ice sheets were thought have existing only within the Arctic circles, Greenland and Antarctica, because global ice ages had not been proposed at this time. Glacial theories were only developed in the early 1800s, and Agassiz focused on the movement of glaciers and even developed theories of mass extinctions because of an ice age. His theory was later then amended because some of the animals he mentioned in his hypothesis were creatures of the ice age, such as the mammoth. Based on landscapes observations by Eduard Brückner and Albrecht Penck, the theory of ice ages took finally shape. Brückner was a Baltic German who became professor in Vienna, so we made him an Austrian, and he was a geographer and expert in alpine glaciers and climate dynamics. Penck, a German geographer, named the ice ages after alpine rivers Günz, Mindel, Riss, and Würm. These names are still in use and describe different glacial periods based on landforms and glacial deposits on land, we call moraines, and in rivers and lakes. Brückner and Penck published a three-volume handbook in 1909, The Alps in the Ice Age. Brückner proposed a certain time cycle of climate changes in cold, damp weather, alternating with warm, dry weather in Northwest Europe. However, more important is that Brückner's hypothesis states also that human behavior, maybe based on Arrhenius' theory, is responsible for changes in the climate. These were now some leading scientists who researched in the Northern Hemisphere, especially in Europe, some Antarctic scientists. First is Erich von Drygalski. He was a German geographer and very familiar with the theories and studies of ice ages and glaciers, in Greenland especially, and wanted to investigate the Antarctic if these theories are also to see in the Southern Hemisphere. The scientific results of 5 international Antarctic expeditions, and Hartley Ferrer and Otto Nordenskjöld were part of this collaboration, they started at the beginning of a systematic investigation of the Antarctic and especially of snow and ice research. I will talk about this in a minute. To continue, Fritz Loewe, a German meteorologist and glaciologist, learned his trade in the Alps and later Greenland on 2 expeditions led by Alfred Wegener. Because he was Jewish, he had to flee Germany in the 1930s and came via England to Australia, and at Melbourne University he founded the Meteorological Institute and could study snow and ice in the Antarctic. In 1956, he published the first book on the Antarctic ice mass balance, unfortunately for many in French. Charles Wythenbank, a British geologist, worked 60 years in both polar regions. He conducted glaciological measurements in the early 1960s, and their precision was confirmed with modern technology 50 years later, especially on the Beardmore Glacier. Wythenbank is the father of the modern observational glaciology, including the use of satellites. Finally, Claude Larousse, who died this year, he was a French glaciologist, incepted the idea of gathering precise information of climate, past climate from the ice cores. The story goes that he had a glass of whiskey with ancient Antarctic ice in his hand and realized air bubbles emerging thousands of years old. Ice core drilling began at Dome Concordia in the mid-1970s, and Larousse was an advocate of the Arrhenius theory of human-induced climate warming. Coming back to Ferrer, Hartley Ferrer, he was a young geologist who did glaciological studies in the Antarctic on the Scott expedition, and that was the contribution from the Scott expedition to climate research and ice and snow. And Otto Nordenskjöld, I will talk now then a little bit later. So what is climate and what is weather? The difference between climate and weather is climate is what you expect. These are the long-term patterns of weather and particular areas. And weather is what we get on the short-term, what happens in the atmosphere and what we get in the weather forecast. So the steps then in glaciological research, when you see the International Commission of Glaciers was already established in 1894, but this was mainly concentrated on the Alps. And the International Glaciological Society was established then in 1936. So you see there is a time span. And snow bit sampling, what is today a common tool to investigate different ice layers, was first time used at the US Antarctic Service Expedition under Byrd in 1939 to 1941. The Norwegian, British, Swedish Antarctic Expedition in 1949 to 1952 was the beginning of the modern glaciology, and Charles Withenbank was on this expedition and started these new technologies. International Geophysical Year is from 1957 to 1958, and new technologies were then used, especially a radar, what was specially developed during World War II, and then also satellite imagery, what came then really into use in the 1970s. This picture down here is from the postgraduate certificate course of Antarctic Studies from 2015-16, when I was the second time in the Antarctic, and I was a part of this as well to try out how it is to determine ice layers. Yeah, the Swedish South Pole Expedition from 1901 to 1903. Otto Nordenskjöld, he was a Swedish geologist and was part of this international collaboration about from five expeditions. And he spent time in the Antarctic in the Weddell Sea area from 1901 to 1903. He explored the Antarctic ice and called it later Larsen Ice Shelf after his captain, Carl Anton Larsen. He worked with the instruments at the time, but observations, traveling with the sledges, he realized the difference between the land ice and the sea ice. He called it shelf ice. But because of understanding problems between the German term shelf ice and the British ice shelf, so it was then used up from the 1950s on as ice shelf in the English-speaking world. He saw when he was traveling on the ice that ice was carrying Nordenskjöld. But his team recognized then quite quickly that there is a difference from the land ice to the ice what is swimming on the sea but is still attached. And modern satellite imagery show this today quite well. However, the line they traveled is not existing anymore because this ice broke away. Massive changes then. And from the 1959 onwards, the animation shows the loss of the Larsen ice shelf over the time. The breaking away of the ice that is already in the water does not contribute to the sea level rise as such. But the ice on the land, what pushes them further down and lands then in the water, this is what contributes to the sea level rise. And this is the danger here. You can also see some of these pictures my husband gave me from 1997. There is a crack in the Larsen ice shelf from the Larsen B. And you see in the left-hand corner some skidoos. And there is a very deep, meters wide crack already, what broke away then in 2001. So there is not traveling possible anymore. So in 2019, when he was with the Weddell Sea expedition, he took this picture. Silnunataks are the reference points again, and you see there is no ice anymore. We can travel over it. With the icebreaker Agalus, they saw that it was not possible to set foot on this anymore, and this is all open water, so no skido can travel there anymore. The Weddell Sea expedition wanted to find Shackleton's Endurance, what sank in 1915, only could it do then in the second expedition. But here also the A68 broke away, and you see from a satellite imagery that there is an ice layer, but it's very thin ice, what that icebreaker can go through. And you see how the iceberg starts to drift through this ice northwards, and it's now drifting around the Antarctic. The other thing here is, I talked about ice drilling, but this was still far away when these pictures were taken. These are historic photos from the Nordenskjöld expedition and the Drygalski expedition in 1901 to 1903. And the ice studies were that they really collected different ice blocks took photographs of it and described everything they could see in there. Each bubble, each line, and of course this triggered a lot of discussion. We are lucky because many of these pictures we can still see in the reports from Nordenskjöld and Trigalski, because their reports are in our Macmillan Brown Library. So this is where I study very often these things as well. Trigalski took photographs and also Nordenskjöld, and these pictures today are still a very good valuable size, especially with the description where they took it and so on. Another historic photo is this one about the ice layers. You see on the top left-hand side, this is from an ice shelf, and you see the layers of the ice. Here is a small, small person that only you can have a dimension how tall it was, but also they investigated drifting icebergs and tried to describe it as much as possible. Of course, with their knowledge of the northern hemisphere of glaciology, they tried to interpret it to the Antarctic and found out this is very similar to it. What also happened is that, of course, they took photos from the ice as such, but also had paintings. Here is one painting from George Marston, who was with the Nimrod and the Endurance expedition with Shackleton. And he painted his pictures then at home, but he took the sketches when he were in the Antarctic. And what is to see is a very small ship on the ice barrier, on the edge of the shelf ice, or the ice shelf, and also massive icebergs. And that we have an impression from the color, but also the impression how that was percepted by the expedition members. You see in the colors it was quite daunting and quite dark. Frank Hurley, who was a photographer on the Mawson expedition, but also on the Endurance expedition, these pictures are very valuable today because it's very clear where they have been taken, and very often this ice is also not available anymore. So we have here some impressions of ice, not only from their aesthetic viewpoint, but also from their scientific viewpoint. Another painter who was with Admiral Byrd in mid-1930s in the Antarctic continues this tradition, and you see always a ship as comparison on an ice edge or very close to an iceberg. Here is the Bear of the Auckland, very close to an ice shelf, and as also, almost as Marston painted it, the little Bear of Auckland on the ice barrier, small ship, big barrier. We also work with Nordenskjöld and others' maps. This is where the Larsen ice shelf should be, and it was there. And these are the lines where the ships were going through when it was summer. But these maps, of course, are not completely accurate for our standards today. But my husband and I are just working on an article to find out how accurate they are and how much we can read into it, what in 120 years happened with the ice in that region, because it is not there anymore. Yeah, how these maps were done. José María Sobral, he was the Argentinian Navy officer with the Nordenskjöld expedition, and you see him taking measurements for mapping on sledge journeys or in very close to the hut. And we also his hands, they are quite swollen. This is from frostbite. You can imagine to take very accurate measurements. It was very hard for the expedition members really to keep health and safety. And some terms of snow and ice, they changed over the last 130 years because the mechanisms are still the same. So the first explorers understood mechanisms, they worked and named it differently. We name it today in another way, but it is still based what we do today on that, what we have from the early explorers. What we see about the ice mass balance today and how it's taught and how we understand it. But you will see over the time, it is still with each question we answer, a new question appears. So this is the common knowledge for us today. So the legacy of the early explorers is, when we compare the historical data sets, they are still valuable for us, for the modern research. But with our modern satellites and radar imagery and all the other things we have, it's really something what we can use and do today. Modern science, of course, on snow and ice is still, as the early explorers did it, without sledges and dogs. We use skidoos today, but in situ research is still very, very valuable and very important to verify the data, what comes from the satellite, what comes from a snow radar, hangs from a aeroplane, and other radar images. So we have to quantify it always so that we get the correct way. However, what has this to do with New Zealand? When my husband and I came in 2006 to New Zealand, a few weeks later, there was the big news that icebergs were drifting very close to New Zealand. But of course, it was also a lot of media frenzy. What does an iceberg here do in the vicinity of New Zealand? And that brings me to the glaciers. This is what I bring now. I have from Heather Birdie. She is here, a geographer at the University of Canterbury, and she works in the Antarctic, but also in the Arctic. So how we investigate the snow and ice is the same in the Arctic, Antarctic, and at home glaciers. We have here a picture from Sir William Fox when he painted a glacier, what is named after him. And we have a reference mountain here on the right-hand side. And on the picture on the right-hand side is the same mountain, but you see hardly anything from the glacier anymore. This picture was taken in 2005. The painting of the glacier was in 1872. The glaciers are heavily retreating in New Zealand. This glacier retreated over the time from 1750 till to 2005, today, so the glacier is almost gone. And these graphs show also, of course, implications. The changes at the Müller Glacier, or the Wewe, or Stocking Glacier, this glacier looked in 1915 still like a stocking. And that was the glacier. And there is no water here around, but a lot of moraines and things like this. In 2018, there is nothing left from the stocking anymore, but all the water in this lake what already drains from there. Of course, this has great implications of our water households here, but also for agricultural work and for the massive climate changes we see almost on a daily basis now. We see it first on the glaciers. They need long to react, but when they react, then they react fast. The other problem I wanted to show you here is from the Tasman Glacier. In 1990, this was a very small lake and the glacier retreated. In 2000 already, the glacier is almost doubled, retreated, but the little lake here is doubled in size. In 2023, it's almost four times bigger than in 1990. The glacier is almost gone, but the lake is coming here. So these are changes what really implicates then also the climate very, very much. So where does this bring us? We have questions. They are still very, very precious. We have to answer them quite quickly. But I think we are in the same situation as the explorers around the 1900s, when they stuck in the ice and tried to find answers for ice ages, for glaciers, for climatology. And this is what we still do today, even when we have very modern instruments nowadays. I will leave you with a little bit more positive things about the impression of icebergs. I have to say, I love the beauty of an iceberg. I love the colors. And it's amazing when you see them close up. Of course, this is a summer event, and this iceberg melts. This is taken, this picture, in Blinot Island, what is the graveyard of the icebergs. So the ground here and, yeah, die. But it's also in the 5 years I've been on the west coast of the Antarctic Peninsula as lecturer on the Antarctic tourist ships. I see changes even between 2018 and 2023. For example, this year we had a very wet summer in the Antarctic, and it was not a very good breeding season for the penguins, for example, because it was too wet. So many of the penguin eggs drowned, or the little penguins froze to death because they were wet, what should not be at this time. But on the other hand, the positive thing is it's really understandable why artists always are inspired by icebergs. And me, inspired by icebergs when I see how they change, to really protect it. So, Noreira, this was it from me. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Ursula Rack giving the annual Jim Gardiner Memorial Lecture, hosted by the Canterbury History Foundation. The lecture was entitled Making Climate Change Visible, A Short History of Antarctic Climate Research. If you'd like more information on the Canterbury History Foundation and its activities, you can go to their website, chf.org.nz.